Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is April 22nd, 2016, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Moving On Up, Higher Floors, Lower Survival for Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest. And we have a guest skeptic, and it's Jay Loosely. Jay is a registered nurse, paramedic, and research assistant. He was a professor at Fanshawe College, but is currently the superintendent of education for Middlesex London Emergency Medical Services. Welcome to the SGEM, Jay.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, we just got together this last week and had a great time at a talk trauma conference in London, Ontario.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was so great to see so many people from all the various disciplines that provide emergency care. I mean, we need to make sure that patients have the best care based on the best evidence from the moment they reach out for help. They call 911 in that pre-hospital setting, en route to the hospital, in the ED, upstairs, and even once they're discharged.
I totally agree. And that's why we're here today, to educate and talk to all of you guys out there about cardiac arrests in high-rise buildings.
Yeah, and that's why we have people like you coming on the SGEM from the EMS world to share in that team sport that we do and discuss that pre-hospital care and those pre-hospital issues.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, give us a case, Jay, that we can talk about.
All right, here's a case. So this is not far-fetched, and this isn't one of those made-up, dreamt cases. These are real, and this is what we see all the time here. So we've got a 43-year-old guy doing his own thing, having a good day, has chest pain, and makes the 911 call. Here's the problem, though. He lives on the 14th floor of a downtown high-rise building. So the 911 dispatcher gets the address, gets the details, and all of a sudden, nothing. Hello? Hello? No more voice contact. So the paramedic response time is about 4 minutes, lights and sirens. They scream across the city, and then they get there, and they wait. And they buzz. They buzz his number. Well, he's not going to answer, so that's not going to help. And then they start buzzing a superintendent. Well, he's not maybe in his room. He's out and about, maybe cleaning up something. So they start buzzing random people. Sorry, Mrs. Smith, the paramedics. We need to get in. Can you let us in, please? Click. Well, she's not interested. Find someone else. Buzz them. Hi, sorry to bother you. It's the paramedics. We just need access in. Click. And we keep doing that. Call police. Call anybody we can. Finally, someone nice lets us in. And then we can make our way up to his apartment. Well, we can knock on his door, but he's all by himself. Well, he's not going to answer. So who's going to get us in? So the partner goes back down the stairs, calls the superintendent, finally gets a hold of him. Hey, we're in the building. We need help getting into apartment number 17 on the 14th floor. So they go back up the stairs, and the superintendent will let us in the apartment, and then we find our guy on the floor, vital signs absent, and he's been there for 15 minutes or so. Well, we've just been kind of hanging out, trying to get in.
That's a pretty sad case. That's a pretty sad case.
It is a sad case, but it's not uncommon.
I don't think people realize what a hard job you guys have trying to access patients in these high-rise buildings.
It's so hard. And add to that, pushing a stretcher around, clunking on all this stuff, hitting doors. It's not easy.
So let's give people some background information. There was some recent data put out by the AHA estimating about 350,000 EMS assessed out-of-hospital cardiac arrests happen every year in the United States. And the median age is about 65 years. Half of these arrests are witnessed, while the other half are unwitnessed.
Yeah, and the majority of these happen at home, right? So 70% or so. And of those EMS treated with cardiac arrest, only about a fourth have an initial shockable rhythm of VF or VT. So survival to discharge from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, isn't that good? Sitting around 6%.
And the AHA came out with an updated CPR ECC guidelines in 2015 that included its chain of survival. And there are 5 steps in this chain of survival for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
And some of them aren't even rocket science. So first you have to recognize and activate call 911. Step 2, well, high quality or high performance CPR. And that's what we've been training on for a long time now.
And we've covered crowdsourcing CPR with smartphones and GPS technology on SGEM number 143. But it has been shown that bystander-initiated CPR increases chance of survival compared to those people who did not get CPR.
Step 3, rapid defibrillation.
Oh, absolutely. It decreases survival of 7 to 10% for each 1 minute delay to defibrillate. So if you're greater than 10 minutes, things are not looking good.
Step 4, basic and advanced cardiac life support and EMS services.
And we covered this back on SGM number 64 with Swami reviewing the classic OPALS trial with Dr. Ian Steele. And while ACLS improved ROSCE and survival to hospital, it did not improve survival to hospital discharge with good neurologic function.
And step 5, advanced life support and post-arrest care.
But we're not going there today, because today we're just going to focus on pre-hospital setting. So what's the clinical question, Jay, that we're going to try to answer on today's podcast?
So the question today, is there an association between floor of patient contact and survival of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest?
And what's the reference?
Drennan et al., out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in high-rise buildings, delays to patient care, and effect on survival.
And this was published in CMAJ 2016. So let's go through the PICO. What was the population?
The population was adults with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest of not obvious cause at private locations.
So they excluded children, those witnessed arrests by first responders, traumatic arrests, or with another obvious cause, or if the arrest took place in a public location. What was the intervention? And in this case, it would be the prognostic factor.
So on or above the third floor.
And what did they compare it to?
Below the third floor.
And what was their primary outcome?
The primary outcome was survival to hospital discharge.
Did they have any secondary outcomes?
It was a subgroup analysis.
All right, so the author's conclusions were, quote, in high-rise buildings, the survival rate after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest was lower for patients residing on higher floors. Interventions aimed at shortening response times to treatment of cardiac arrest in high-rise buildings may increase survival. All right, Jay, let's go through the quality checklist for observational trials. The first question is, did the study address a clearly focused issue?
Yes, it did.
Did the authors use an appropriate method to answer their question?
They sure did. You can't randomize people for their out-of-hospital cardiac arrest.
And was the cohort recruited in an acceptable way?
Yes, all consecutively treated adults with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest of no obvious cause at a private location.
And was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes, it was.
How about the outcome? Was it accurately measured to minimize bias?
Well, that's pretty good. Yes, it was. Dead or alive. Fairly easy to measure.
Yeah, you can't be mostly dead. All right, number 6. Have the authors identified all important confounding factors?
No, and we're going to discuss this in detail in the nerdy section.
Ah, one of my favorite sections. And was the follow-up of subjects complete enough?
Yes.
And how precise were the results?
Point estimates were provided for odds ratios with 95% confidence intervals.
Jay, do you believe the results?
I do.
Do you think you can apply them to your local population?
Absolutely. In urban areas with high-rise buildings, for sure.
And do you think the results of this study fit with other available evidence?
Yes. While no other studies have specifically investigated this question of elevation, we do know that delays to CPR and defib for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest decrease chance of survival.
All right, so let's go through the key results. They had about 8,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests that met inclusion, and about 6,000, or 3/4, were below the third floor, and about 2,000, or 1/4 of them, were on the third floor or higher.
So there were baseline differences between the two groups. Those on or above the third floor were more likely to be female, less often witnessed, took EMS longer to reach, and were less likely to be in a shockable rhythm.
And overall, the survival to hospital discharge was 3.8%, regardless of what floor you were on. But what was the primary outcome? And I'll remind everybody, the primary outcome was survival below the third floor versus third floor or above.
Lower survival was associated with third floor or above odds ratio of 0.70, 95% confidence interval of 0.5 to 0.9.
So another way to express that is that they had 4.2% survival if you were below the third floor versus 2.6% if you're on the third floor or above. So they had a 1.6% absolute difference. Now, they did do some subgroup analysis, and this was based on the building type, and they found about 2,300 cases of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in adults living in apartment buildings.
survival was 5.2% for those cases below a third floor apartment and 2.7% for those cases above the third floor apartment.
They also looked at time to patient contact. And what they did was they measured the time of arrival of 911-initiated first responders on the scene to the actual patient contact and found a difference of almost 2 minutes longer for patients on the higher floors. It was 4.9 minutes versus 3 minutes. Yeah, and then they looked at some other variables, Jay, that were independently associated with lower survival to hospital discharge.
Older age, male, sex, longer 911 response times.
And they also had variables independently associated with higher rates of survival to hospital discharge.
Initial shockable rhythm and witnessed arrest.
And I'll put all the details with the odds ratios and the 95% confidence intervals on the blog. But a couple of other interesting data points. Survival rate above the 16th floor was 0.9%, or 2 out of 216 arrests.
And survival rate was 0% for those above the 25th floor.
And they didn't have that many in that group. They only had 30 for out-of-hospital cardiac arrests above the 25th floor. But zero is still zero.
Not good. Yeah, zero is dead.
So now it's time to talk nerdy. And this was a really interesting study asking about delays in care of out-of-hospital cardiac arrests in a unique way. And so once again, I reached out to the lead author, in this case, Ian Drennan, who agreed to come on the show. Ian is a PhD candidate at Rescue St. Michael's Hospital and the Institute of Medical Science at the University of Toronto. He works as an advanced care paramedic with York Regional Paramedic Services and is an instructor with the Sunnybrook Center for Pre-Hospital Medicine. Ian also holds a faculty position in the Health Science Department at both Georgian College and Centennial College. Welcome to the SGEM, Ian.
Hi, Ken. Thanks. It's great to be here.
So we have five issues for you, Ian, and we wanted to go through these with you about your recent publication. And Jay, I think you're going to start things off.
So number one, observational trial. The biggest limitation of this study is that it was an observational trial. In this type of study design, only associations can be demonstrated, not causation.
So Jay, yeah, you're absolutely right. So as with all observational research designs, there are inherent limitations that are associated with this type of study. The biggest being that we are unable to actually show any causation between our variable of interest and our outcomes. So although we found an association between higher floors and decreased survival, even after we controlled for some of the other well-known predictors of survival, we're still unable to actually determine a cause and effect relationship between the higher floors and patient outcomes. So this is because we can't account for all of the possible confounding variables that may affect this relationship. So although we know some of these variables and we're able to account for some of them through statistical analysis, we can't actually possibly account for every one of them that might be at play here. So I don't think, you know, looking at the study, I don't think there's actually anything physical about the higher floors that all of a sudden you survive less if you cross over that third floor barrier. So there must actually be some other confounding factors that are associated with the higher floors that are at least partially responsible for the results we found. So I think the reasons why this association was actually seen need to be further investigated. But nonetheless, it's interesting that there was an association in our data between the cardiac arrests on higher floors and a poor outcome.
So the second thing we wanted to talk about was the other associations you found beyond elevation that increase or decrease your chance of survival.
Yeah, so as part of the analysis, we examined the effect of floor of the cardiac arrest on survival while we actually controlled for some of the other known predictors of survival, such as a patient's age, their initial cardiac rhythm, so whether it was a shockable rhythm like VF or VT or a non-shockable rhythm, whether it was witnessed by bystanders, and whether those bystanders actually performed any CPR prior to 911 responders getting there. And finally, what the 911 response time was getting to the patient. So what we found was after controlling for these variables that older age, male sex, and a longer 911 response time were all independently associated with worse patient outcomes.
Well, Ian, I think we can all agree that older people, they generally do worse. And longer response times are bad when you're having a cardiac arrest.
Yeah, absolutely. And intuitively, that makes sense. And as well, as consistently, this also plays out through the literature that's also examined these factors, that these happen to be associated with worse outcomes. So something else we also found was that initial shockable cardiac rhythms and bystander witness cardiac arrests were associated with higher rates of survival. And again, these factors are typically associated with improved patient outcomes in other previous cardiac arrest studies. So none of these results were overly surprising.
Yeah, again, previous data has shown that people with witnessed arrests and those found in a shockable rhythm do better.
So what was your overall rate of CPR in this study?
Yeah, so overall, we had about 35% bystander CPR rate, which is fairly standard for our rates within the city of Toronto, higher in other jurisdictions, but around ours, it's generally around 35%. However, the rate of AED use was actually less than 1% within our study.
So this is interesting. So you did not find a difference in survival with bystander CPR. Was it just a no difference between above or below the third floor, or no difference in CPR in general for survival?
No, yeah, good question. So the rate of bystander CPR was actually the same on higher floors and lower floors, and both of them were around 35%. However, when we looked at the impact of bystander CPR on patient survival, in our unadjusted analysis, we found a significant result. But when we started to control for these other known predictors that we had just talked about for survival, then we found a non-significant effect of bystander CPR. Now, I wouldn't suggest based on this study that bystander CPR is not important. Overall survival from cardiac arrest, as you can imagine, is a complex topic and complicated by numerous other factors such as medication administration, in-hospital treatments, and a lot of other things that weren't measured in this study. And bystander CPR is just one of many important factors that's actually needed to improve survival. Bystander CPR has been shown to improve survival in a number of other papers that have focused specifically on that topic. So my interpretation of the results of our results with the bystander CPR is that first, survivors and non-survivors both had relatively decent rates of bystander CPR, 45% and 35% respectively. And second, it appears in our analysis that because other variables such as the initial cardiac rhythm that we talked about and the witness status has such a big effect on survival, which again is common in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest research, that these variables plus the increased delay that we found in our study to CPR by paramedics may have actually blunted the overall positive effect of bystander CPR. I think something else that's worth mentioning is that although there was no effect on survival, bystander CPR was associated with increased rates of return to circulation. And obviously, if there's no return to circulation, then there's no survival.
The fourth question we wanted to ask you about, Ian, was the overall survival. You found that survival to discharge for adults with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest was 3.8%. Now, this is less than the 5% found in the OPAL study by Ian Steele. Why do you think there was a difference?
Yeah, great question. So a few potential reasons why our survival might have been slightly lower than the study, than the OPAL study. So first, our population was a bit different than OPAL's, as we required a specific group of patients to actually answer our specific research question. So specifically, we only included cardiac arrests that occurred in private residences, which are known to have a lower survival than cardiac arrests that occur in public locations. And also, we excluded EMS witnessed cases. Again, so this group is also known to have higher survival than non-EMS witnessed cardiac arrests. Second, some of the other contributing factors that are associated with higher survival, such as the witness status and the initial shockable rhythms, these were also lower in our study than the OPAL study as well.
So question number five, you reported survival to discharge, but not survival to discharge with good neurologic condition. Would this be an important thing to report?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. In our study, we only reported on survival to hospital discharge, so whether they survived, yes or no. And we didn't specifically look at neurologic outcomes of patients at hospital discharge when they survived.
Yeah, but patients, they don't want to just survive, Ian. They want to thrive. They want to be neurologically intact. And if the increase to survival to hospital discharge was just for these patients to be institutionalized in some long-term care facility with poor neurologic function, I don't think many of us would consider that a positive outcome.
No, and I completely agree. I can tell you from other research using our data that the vast majority of our patients who do survive do so with actually a good neurologic status. But this would definitely be an interesting and important outcome to look at as well for the patients that we included in this study.
So those are all the critical appraisal questions, but we want to know, what's the most common question you have received after publishing this research?
Yeah, great question. So as you can imagine, there was a lot of media attention that came after this study came out. So I had a lot of very interesting questions that came up. One of the more common questions was, I have heard from a lot of people was, you know, my parents live on the 20th floor of a condo building. So should we now be concerned because they live so high and maybe sell, or should we move them down to a lower floor? So lots of people wondering what this meant for their living arrangements. And I think, you know, an important message for the public was, you know, let's not panic. This, as we already discussed here, this is an observational study. We can't determine any causation from this study. And I think there's some possible solutions that might help to minimize any noted differences in 911 response times and survival.
I love what you just said there. don't panic. Well, thanks, Ian, for coming on the SJAM and discussing your research paper in more detail.
Thanks, Ken. It's been my pleasure.
Well, we're going to move on and comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SJAM's conclusions.
We generally agree with the author's conclusions.
So the SJAM bottom line is, we need to find ways to maximize bystander CPR, improve access to AEDs, and eliminate barriers for first responders. Now, Jay, can you give us a case resolution?
So here's what happened. Medics arrived at the patient. They started CPR. Defib pads were put on. The first rhythm analysis was a fine VF. They shocked him at 200 joules. IV was started. Milligram of epi was given, just like you see in the movies. The next rhythm check, a systole. Patient was intubated. More epi is given. And the end tidal's falling. It's now down to 10. So a call to the physician is made. Consult takes place. And the patient is pronounced dead at the scene.
So now we come to the point where we think about, how are we going to clinically apply this research? And you know what? Ian is still on the call. So Ian, why don't I pull you back in? And why don't you tell us how you think we should clinically apply this research?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a couple important takeaways from the study. The first to me is that there needs to be an awareness that, you know, even though you're still in an urban center, that there is some potential barriers in place that impact 911 response and potentially survival in high-rise buildings. And it's funny, I told some of my paramedic colleagues about this study, and they were all like, well, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It takes us forever to get to these patients. We can't even get in the buildings. We can't get the elevators to fit our stretchers. So it seems like this is a well-known problem. It's just no one's actually described this problem yet. So I think there's a couple of things that can be done to help to mitigate any effect that's seen. The first is to try to maximize the chain of survival that you've already discussed for these cases. And this kind of starts with maximizing the impact of bystander interventions. And so this might even just start with ensuring that all residents in high-rise buildings are actually just trained in providing CPR. I mean, we need to make sure as many people as possible are actually trained in CPR. In some jurisdictions, they've had great success integrating public response programs using cell phone applications for cardiac arrests. And maybe there's a way that we can actually integrate something similar to this for people living in high-rise buildings so that, you know, if 911 is called for a potential cardiac arrest, that other people within the building can actually get notified, or maybe the superintendent, security services, someone else within the building that's able to go up there quicker than the 911 responders, bring an AED and actually start to apply these bystander interventions rapidly to the patient. Second thing I think that needs to happen is we need to ensure that there's actually AEDs placed in the residential high-rise buildings. Not only placed in them, but that are actually easily accessible for bystanders to use if this situation comes along. So an interesting topic then is, well, where do we actually place these AEDs? So clearly it's not practical to actually place an AED on every single floor just in case that floor happens to have one of these cardiac arrests. And since we can't, you know, predict where the next one's going to happen, where do we actually put them? So do we standardize them, say, on every fifth floor? Do they get placed in the lobby? You know, the lobby is a long way from the 50th floor, so if the cardiac arrest occurs way up on the 50th floor, they have to all of a sudden get way down to the lobby and then all the way back up again. That's, you know, wasting time again. So another interesting idea perhaps might be to best utilize an AED by placing it in the elevator itself. So then people would know, they know where they are because they'll be passing them every day in and out as they go in and out of the building. And not only that, but if they actually need one because there's a cardiac arrest close by, they can just call the elevator up, which might save valuable minutes as well for a cardiac arrest patient. And third, I think the third most important message is to ensure that we can actually minimize any delays for 911 responders that are responding to calls in high-rise buildings. So like I said, all my paramedic colleagues were all like, yeah, we all know where these delays occur. And there is known delays that occur when we're responding to these calls. The first big one is actually gaining access to the building. So as Jay described earlier in the case, sometimes you're sitting there frantically at the front door calling person after person after person trying to let you in. So if we can make sure that paramedics and firefighters all have universal access to the buildings at the front door, this could save valuable minutes as well. And then ensuring that there's no elevator delays. So the elevator's waiting at the ground floor, that it's not already up on another floor, that the public aren't using it. Because sometimes even that, if it has to stop at every floor on the way down as people are trying to get out of the building, even that can take minutes before it's actually available for paramedics to use. So trying to ensure that the elevator's waiting on the ground floor. And then sometimes even when you get off the elevator up on the floor with the cardiac arrest, there's not good signage as to which way the apartment that you're actually looking for. So I think those are three ways that we can actually improve access for 911 responders when they're actually going to these calls.
That's great. All right, Jay, so what are you going to tell your patient?
Well, I don't know if you know this or not, Ken, but the patient is dead. So on the way out, though, the neighbor will come over and say, what took you guys so long? What were you dilly-dallying down there? I saw your ambulance pull up. Then you came up here about 15 minutes later. So it's about the discussion, talking to them about, well, I know, ma'am, but we were in the lobby for about 10 minutes, buzzing everybody we could possibly find to let us in. And then we had to come up here and we couldn't get in the building for all of the reasons that Ian addressed. So it's about finding the solutions to those and creating bylaws and working with all these groups to for access.
All right, now it's time for the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Crystal McLeod, an ER nurse from Hanover. She knew the HART score was first published in 2008. Jay, what's the Keener question this week?
Keener question today is, what is the tallest building in the world?
Well, if you know the answer, then send it to thesgem@gmail.com. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, just a brief conference update. The Tom Steele Symposium is coming up on May 6th in Springfield, Missouri. SAEM is in New Orleans, May 10th to 13th. And the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians annual meeting is June 4th to 8th in beautiful Quebec City. Ian, really appreciate you coming on the SGEM to discuss your paper. What research project are you working on now?
Yeah, well, Ken, you know, research never stops. So once that one comes out, we're on to the next thing. So currently right now, we have a couple follow-up projects that we're thinking about based on this trial. One is about looking at AED placements and where we might be able to optimize AED placements in these buildings. Second things we're working on is just looking at some of these other factors that we've discussed about cardiac arrest survival and which of these other factors might improve survival for these patients as well.
Well, we'll look for your next publication and maybe we'll get you back on the SGEM one more time.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Ken.
And thanks, Jay, for coming on the SGEM and being our guest skeptic and helping us cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year.
Thanks so much, Ken. This was a blast.
And as the guest skeptic, you get to give the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to you next time.